Well, I'm glad to be here. It's my second time visiting Tallinn. By the way, just so you know, I knew Daniel when he was a tiny baby. I lived in Milwaukee. No, I never changed his diaper. I make it official. I knew him when he was wearing them, but no, I never actually cleaned his butt, you know, whatever. Never did that. It's so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing when they knew you when you were little. All right, great. So anyway, I'm going to speak on God and science. So let me give you a little bit of my own personal background. So I grew up going to a church. It was a very liberal sort of Protestant denomination. And so I was the guy who would wear those funny robes and kind of do that. But and I was even the president of the church youth group. But I didn't believe in God. How I could be the president of the church youth group not believing in God, I guess it didn't really matter in that church. So I went off to college, and I was actually quite proud to be an atheist. And I can remember living in a dorm, and there was a Christian guy coming to speak, and the guy in the dorm was sharing his faith. I remember laughing at him. I'm so funny. And I also, my freshman year, I took a philosophy course. We studied Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said, you know, God is dead. I was like, yeah, that's so cool. Of course, Nietzsche's dead, and God seems to be doing okay. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually have two parts to my talk. First will be why I believe science leads us inevitably to the conclusion that there is a God. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about evidence from the Bible itself that and science for why I believe the Bible is inspired by God. So I'm going to present two different viewpoints. One would be that of Thomas Huxley. You might have heard of Thomas Huxley. He was a good friend of Charles Darwin. Darwin was not an atheist, but Huxley was. And so here's his perspective. He says, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth, or the ebb and flow of the tides, we have just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." So according to this atheist perspective, it's all an accident. There's no purpose, no design. It's just no reasoning to it at all. So a molecule bumps into a molecule, life happens, and then just we happen by accident. Okay, that's the atheist idea. A more modern version of this would come with Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, he's still alive. He wrote the book called The God Delusion. He's one of the most famous atheists today. He says something similar. He says, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any reason, nor justice, no justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music. What a depressing thought. But if it's true, it's true, I guess. So the idea then is no purpose, no justice, no design, all just accident. And my question is that a reasonable view for a scientist to take? I'm going to conclude that that is not a reasonable view, not at all. Okay, another view would be the idea of design. All right, could I, Daniel, borrow your cell phone here. So let's imagine William Paley, a British physicist, is famous for this illustration. So his was the watchmaker argument. Mine's going to be the cell phone maker argument. Okay, got it. So let's imagine, you know, you're walking down the street, you see a cell phone. And the question is, how did that get there? Well, according to this view, it just happened. A series of singularly beneficial accidents. So, you know, there's some glass and some metal, some silicon, you know, and maybe a car went over, some rain. All of a sudden, cell phone. Do you believe that? No. That is irrational. To claim that it just happened, that'd be crazy. Here's the question. Which has more evidence of design, a cell phone or the simplest bacteria? I say the simplest bacteria is a nano factory of unimaginable complexity. And yet, the atheist says, it just happened. So what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to do a quick review of some of the things that I would teach, and I have taught many times, in an introductory chemistry or physics class, and talk about why those things point to God. Because, like I was telling my story, I forgot to finish my story. I ended with the depressing fact that I was an atheist. Okay, but then, as I began to take chemistry and physics, I began to realize there's no way atheism works. There has to be a God. So then I decided to seek after that God. Now, but I wasn't assuming Christianity, so I was attracted actually to Buddhism and Hinduism. And I joined sort of a westernized Hindu thing. There's a lot of that stuff out here. In fact, I was sharing with a guy just a couple days ago, and he kind of go the whole Bhagavad Gita thing. All right? But then I came across a Christian church, kind of like the one that's putting on this event. And then I was challenged to read the Bible. And then I came to the conclusion that the Bible is inspired by God. All right, so I'm going to talk about some evidence for the existence of God from science. Now, hopefully you don't need this help. Hopefully you see H-O-H. You already knew that was water. Yes? I'm glad to tell you. Okay, now, I could teach an entire one-semester course just to explain all the properties unique to water. Every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. There are dozens, literally dozens of properties that water has that are unique to water and no other molecule. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. This says design to me. All right, for example, in order for life to exist, there needs to be a liquid, which is the solvent that could support that living system. And chemists will tell you that life could only exist between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Below minus 20 centigrade, there's not enough energy for chemical reactions to occur. Above 80 degrees centigrade or so, complicated molecules just fall apart. Now, water is liquid across almost that entire range. Now, we're very fortunate because water is bent. Water's bent at about a 105 degree angle. If water was straight, then it would boil at roughly minus 150 degrees centigrade. That would be a problem because we would all infinitely vaporize. All right. Now, another property of water is that in order for life to exist, the liquid within which that life could exist would have to be able to dissolve a very wide variety of molecules. It just so happens that water dissolves a wider variety of molecules than any other. The one that has the right boiling point, the right freezing point, has the widest variety of dissolving molecules. Now, in order for life to exist, it is essential that that liquid would dissolve ions, like sodium chloride. If you had a little chemistry, you know about that. Guess how many compounds that are liquid in the minus 20 to 80 degrees centigrade that dissolve ions? Only one. Water is the only molecule that is liquid in that temperature range which dissolves ions. But that's not the only property unique to water. For example, water absorbs more heat by far than any other molecule. In fact, the average molecule absorbs roughly one-tenth as much heat as water. The closest competitor absorbs half as much heat as water. You say, why is that important? because if it were not for the heat-absorbing properties of water, the temperature of the earth would go up and down by 150 degrees centigrade in any given year. No life. There are other properties of water. For example, one of the properties of water is that the solid floats on the liquid. There are millions of molecules. Guess how many molecules have the solid floating on the liquid? Only one. Only water. You might think, well, why does water solid float on the liquid? Well, that's a chemistry problem. And you say, well, why is that important? The reason that's important is when it gets cold, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, in the winter, the lakes would freeze to the bottom. And during an ice age, the entire oceans would freeze to the bottom and life would cease to exist, other than maybe some bacteria. Now, another product of molecules is when you heat them up, their density goes down. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one. Only water. Because when water, when you heat it up, the density goes down. And when you cool it off, the density goes up. But then at 4 degrees centigrade, water goes like this. Okay? It actually gets denser when you're, less dense when you're cooling it off. Okay, why is that important? Because in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the colder water, which floats on top of the warmer water. And you know about convection currents? It goes against that. Again, otherwise, lakes would freeze to the bottom. I could talk about the viscosity of water. There's so many other properties. Now, the way I see it, two possible explanations of all this. An accident or design. Now, if this was the only example, I think it would be an amazing example of design. But it's not the only example. Now, some of you right now are getting very nervous and maybe sweating and, you know, yes. Now, I tell my students that Mendeleev, the Russian chemist, invented this chart. Actually, 3 years ago, I was in Kiev, and I lectured in his lecture hall. That was so cool. So I tell my students that he invented this chart, and historically that's true. But guess who I think invented that chart? God invented that chart. There are at least 20 elements that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. A good question for the atheist is, why are there so many elements? And my answer is because there needs to be so many different properties in order for life to exist. So God created a universe with so many elements. Okay? So let me give some examples. Do we have any chemists here? Anybody take some chemistry? All right, so which element am I going to talk about to be essential for life and all its properties? Is that carbon?
Carbon, yeah.
Yes. Oh, you're talking about all the elements. That's true. All right. So I teach organic chemistry. And when I teach organic chemistry, I spend the first week of the course explaining all the properties unique to carbon. And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, and by the way, it has to have all those properties. If carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. All right, so for example, carbon forms four bonds. Now, actually, carbon is not the only element that forms four bonds. Also, silicon forms four bonds. But the problem with silicon is if you put two silicon atoms together in a molecule, that molecule explodes. That wouldn't work. Now, why is four bonds important? The reason four bonds is important is until you have four bonds, the molecule is not three-dimensional. So if you don't have four bonds, then you don't have three-dimensional molecules. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, you don't have three-dimensional living things. And that would be a problem. Now, also, it just so happens, not only is carbon the only element that forms molecules with four bonds, it's also the only element that forms large molecules. And what if you had no ability to form large molecules? Then could you have life? Certainly not. And anyway, in my organic chemistry class, I talk about the fact that it forms single, double, and triple bonds, and all those things that are so hard to translate into Russian if you don't know a lot of that. We'll just say several other things about carbon that are unique to carbon. Ask me later, and I'll tell you about them. Okay, another one is iron. Iron has a property unique to iron, and that is, it's the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. And you say, well, why do we need something with a strong magnetic field? Well, otherwise, how could you have, you know, your homework on your refrigerator or something like that? No. It turns out there's a very good reason why we need a magnetic element. And the reason is this. Turns out the sun, now I could talk about the design of the sun. The design of the sun is incredible. Oops, went the wrong, there we go, the sun. It turns out, though, the sun creates a huge amount of energy, and over 80% of the energy produced by the sun is in the form of visible light. Lucky for us, because visible light is the only form of energy that can cause chemical reactions without destroying the molecules. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun that would destroy all life. One of them is the solar wind. It's the high-energy charged particles. And those would destroy all life on Earth, except for the fact that the Earth has a magnetic field. And that magnetic field literally is a force field that bends those around the Earth. You guys have the Northern Lights here, yes? Yes? We don't have it in California. It's so boring. And that's because, to some extent, it bends them near the North Pole. All right, now, here's an interesting fact about iron, though. Not only is iron the only element that forms a strong magnetic field, it just so happens that iron has the most stable nucleus. And so guess what the Earth is made out of mostly? Iron. And if iron did not form the most stable nucleus, then being magnetic wouldn't help us at all. So it just so happens the only element that's magnetic is also the most common element in a rocky planet. Now, remember our friend, what's his name? Huxley. He said, a lot of coincidences. I say, that's a pretty good accident. All right? I could talk about oxygen. Because the other kind of energy that comes from the sun that would destroy all life is ultraviolet radiation. The short ultraviolet is very dangerous to life. So God made another element. It's called oxygen. Now, the cool thing about oxygen is it comes in two varieties. One is O2, which is the only atmospheric substance that could sustain a high metabolism form of life. But the other form of oxygen is O3, ozone, which is very poisonous. But luckily, there's almost no ozone near the surface. Almost all the ozone is in the upper atmosphere, where it absorbs the ultraviolet light. Thank you, God, for ozone. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Now, I could talk about the unique properties of helium, the unique properties of hydrogen, of copper. I'm just going to do one more, and that's going to be uranium. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous, right? And there's a reason, because it is dangerous. And the reason it's dangerous is because it's radioactive. But actually, you might be surprised, uranium is not really nearly as dangerous as you think, because it has a very, very long half-life. It's the things produced from uranium that are actually dangerous. In fact, uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Lucky for us, because if it were not for uranium being radioactive, then it gives off energy inside the Earth. Otherwise, the Earth would be cold all the way to the middle. then we'd have no plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is a massive recycling system which recycles the minerals in the earth. Otherwise, the surface of the earth would be sterile. And also, if it were not for plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere. In fact, if you want to be on a planet with almost no uranium, go to Mars. Almost no uranium. And almost no atmosphere and a sterile surface. All right? So thank you, God, for creating radioactive uranium. By the way, it's also required for mutations and evolution and a few other things. All right. Now let's talk about a little bit about biochemistry. Really, I could spend the entire lecture just talking about the amazing design behind biochemistry. And DNA, I'm kind of a nerd. Do they have a word nerd? All right. Kind of nerdy. What's the word for nerdy in Russian? I don't know. Is there there's a word for that? All right. Yeah, there is. Okay. But it's kind of like, it's really cool. It's really cool. DNA is so awesome. And now DNA is made out of nucleotides. You've probably heard of nucleotides. And you're aware of the G, the C, the A, and the T, the adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. Now, those represent rather complex molecules, but it turns out those four make a code. And the way it works is three of those nucleotides is a code to choose an amino acid in order to make proteins. Now, let me ask a simple, common sense question. Could a code be created by random accidental collisions of molecules? The answer is, of course not. But there's people who actually believe it happened that way. They're called atheists. But, you know, they have to believe a lot of amazing coincidences. You know, it takes faith to be a Christian. But I'm telling you, it takes a lot of faith to be an atheist, especially a science atheist. You know, these atheist scientists, they try to create the impression that obviously a scientist wouldn't believe in God. That's for people who believe in tooth fairies and pixie dust. But I want to challenge that point of view. Like I said, it takes an amazing amount of faith to hold on to atheism in light of this evidence. Now, the amount of information, because basically, we all contain an incredible amount of coded information. For us, 3 billion of these base pairs. But let's give a little bit of space to the atheists. Let's imagine the simplest life, for example, bacteria. A simple bacteria, 100 million of these letters, if you will. All right, let's give them a little extra. Okay, 50 million. Okay, well, just say 25 million. 25 million pieces of information. The probability of that much information being created by random collisions of molecules, it'd be like this. Let's imagine taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read it in Estonian. People say, well, if you give it enough time... Time does not solve that problem. Now, nature creates order spontaneously. It does. All right? So nature creates order spontaneously, but it never, ever creates information spontaneously. There are no exceptions. So how does the atheist get around this? By ignoring it or just assuming it, which is circular reasoning. So now, let me tell you another interesting fact. The only thing in the universe that makes, the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. And the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. You know the whole story about the chicken and the egg, which came first? That's an easy one. To the atheist, which came first, DNA or protein? Now, there's this RNA world theory, which is nonsense for reasons that I cannot explain. Too many technical... Well, I'll just go ahead and explain it. Because the job of DNA is to contain information, and the job of proteins is to do all the work in a living thing. Now, it just so happens that RNA can contain a little bit of information, and it can even do a little bit of work, but not even close. It doesn't even come close to being able to contain the information in a living thing. Neither does it come even close to being able to catalyze all the reactions in a living thing. This is a theory that has nothing to it. It's fantasy. All right? So here's what the atheist believes, and I'm not kidding. What they believe is by some long series of beneficial accidents, not only did all the DNA required to produce a living thing happen by accident, also, simultaneously, the protein that would have made the DNA had to also be created, but not from the DNA. So in other words, the DNA that would have made the protein and the protein that would have made the DNA, they both have to simultaneously have been created in the same place, and suddenly it's alive. Again, this borders on irrational. And, you know, atheists, they confidently say, oh, we'll have a theory to explain this eventually. But I'm telling you, no, they won't. No, they won't. All right, fine. This is Charles Darwin. I like this. It is rubbish to think at this point of the origin of life. That's Darwin. And I agree with it. Rubbish. Nonsense. Craziness. But atheists believe in it. Now, why do they believe in it? Because if they don't believe in it, then they have to stop being an atheist. So why do they want to be an atheist so bad? Ask them. It's not my job to answer that question. Now, let's talk a little bit about physics. Just a little bit about physics. Okay, before the 1940s, physicists were unanimous everywhere that the universe was eternal. Okay? Now, why were they so sure that the universe was eternal? The reason they were sure the universe was eternal was not because of the evidence, because there was no scientific evidence the universe was eternal. So why did they think the universe was eternal? Because the only other option is that it was created. And if the universe was created, that doesn't create a scientific problem. It creates a philosophical problem. So they said the universe was eternal. Now, the Bible all along had said, for example, in Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand the universe was created so that what is seen has been made from things that are not visible. And guess what? In the 1930s and 40s, physicists caught up with the Bible. They came up with this idea of what we call the Big Bang model. In the 1930s, it was discovered that the universe is expanding very, very rapidly. They discovered the red shift. And then physicists made up this excuse theory called the steady state theory to try to save eternal creation, eternal universe. But then, sorry, a technicality, they discovered this microwave radiation that fills the universe, and it proved that that's not true. So guess what? All physicists now agree that the universe has not always existed. In fact, at a point in the past, from nothing, all matter, all energy, all space, and even all time were created from nothing in a brilliant flash of light. As the Bible says, let there be light. So, thank you for catching up. Now, as cosmologists and high-energy physicists started analyzing this event, by the way, whether the Big Bang happened or not, I honestly don't know, but the evidence is consistent with that. So as a scientist, we only propose theories that are consistent with the evidence, so that makes it a good theory. So my opinion is, yeah, that's actually what happened. Okay? Now, When physicists started to look more carefully at this event, assuming it had happened, they noticed some amazing coincidences. What they noticed is there are several parameters that govern this event, all of which have to be extremely precise. If you change them the smallest amount, the whole thing doesn't work. Thing is, all of them are like that. So sometimes they talk about the finely tuned universe. Because in order for the orchestra to work, every instrument has to be tuned to the same frequency. That's kind of the analogy. Let me give one example. I want to talk about gravity. Now, would you agree that that is a small number? I think you will. 59 zeros and then a 1. Now, here's the fact about the universe. What they discovered is, see, gravity is a very, very weak force. The other three fundamental forces are far stronger than gravity. But the good thing about gravity is it acts over vast distances. And gravity is the thing responsible for creating galaxies and stars and planets and all that. Now, what they discovered was if gravity was weaker than it is by that fraction, then galaxies and planets would have never formed. But it turns out if gravity had been stronger than it is by the same fraction, then the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it formed. So I have two questions for the atheist. Number one, why does gravity exist? Because it does. That's not a very good explanation. And why does gravity have the right value? Because of a very, very beneficial accident. Let me explain how beneficial this accident is. Do they have anything like a lottery here in Estonia? Yes? Let's imagine that your friend won the big lottery. What would you say? You'd say, awesome. But I thought you were a Christian. Why are you playing the lottery? Besides, you're not even 21. I don't know how old you have to be. But anyway, whatever. Now, what if your friend won the big lottery again the next week? And then they won the big lottery again the next week. They're going to be arrested. Correct?
Yeah.
Now, the probability, let's say you just randomly picked a gravity force. The probability of getting the right gravity force, it would be like winning the big lottery 6 times in a row. What's that probability? So what physicists have done is they've made up this crazy idea of the multiverse. They say there's an infinite number of universes and we live in the right one. Now guess how much evidence they have for that theory? That is not even a scientific theory. It is literally not even a scientific theory. Because a scientific theory, by definition, needs to be provable by experiment. It also needs to be disprovable by experiment. And that theory is neither of the above. Therefore, I would say, by definition, it's not even a scientific theory. All right, good. Now, there's way too much information here. But it turns out the list, it keeps going and going and going. It's not just gravity. There are four fundamental forces. Gravity, electric, nuclear strong, nuclear weak, whatever. Don't worry about the details. Every single one of them are tuned very precisely. For example, the nuclear strong force. That's what attracts the proton and the neutron to each other. A few percent bigger, no hydrogen and no stars. Problem. Just a few percent smaller, only hydrogen. Also a big problem. Okay, and we could go on and on and on. All right, so my conclusion is with Fred Hoyle, a well-known physicist, who said a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. And I haven't even talked about biology. Okay, Anthony Flew, probably the most famous like intellectual atheist in the second half of the 20th century, about 10 years ago, he finally gave up. He said, all right, obviously there's a creator. But that's just one guy. Okay, I could talk about the right kind of galaxy. There's a bunch of other stuff. So Here is my conclusion, because I'm halfway through my talk. Just over halfway. My conclusion is this. You know, you get the impression from these really smart people, these scientists and stuff, that, you know, obviously no smart person would believe in the Bible. All right? But I'd say, I'd go with Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And I would say, you know who has the least excuse for not believing in God? It's the scientist. I don't know what they're talking about. You know, I shared a story last night. How many of you were there last night? All right, enough. I won't bore you with that story. But there's part of the story I didn't tell you. It's about this lady who said, "Ha ha ha! What a stupid religion, Christianity!" And she quoted something about the Old Testament, which was totally false. But I didn't mention to you the actual response to her that I gave, because I said to her, after telling her she was wrong, and she insisted she was right. And so what I said to her is, you know, people say that no scientist could ever be a Christian because there's all these science errors in the Bible. And I said, I've read the Bible half a dozen times, and I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. People say this, but can they give an example? I'm a pretty skeptical guy. I mean, I have a PhD in chemical physics, you know, so that's kind of my training. And if there was a science error in the Bible, I don't know, I think I would have found it by now. But anyway, part two, science in the Bible. This is a statement of Dallas McCown. He's an evolutionist, a very famous evolutionist. He's an atheist. He says, Christianity is scientifically unsupported. Really? My talk just didn't happen, I guess. You know, it's just a fantasy. Probably insupportable. At least he says probably. I'll give him credit for that. It's philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. Let's just go there for a minute. Basically, what he's saying is no historian could ever believe the Bible because it has so many fables, so many obvious lies. Here's my response. Can you give me one example? Can you give me any historical or archaeological fact which shows the Bible to be wrong? Guess how many of those there are? None. And I don't have time tonight, but we could do a whole presentation. I could show you dozens of archaeological finds. By the way, archaeology does not prove the Bible. I can't prove that David killed the Goliath with archaeology. So you cannot prove the Bible with archaeology, but what you can prove is this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm telling you, he literally doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just talking. Philosophically suspect at best, all right? I would put Christian philosophy against atheist philosophy any day. Any day. But let's get back to the first one. Scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. All right, so let's talk about that a little bit. Now, this is Papyrus Ebers. It's not the whole thing. It's just one page. It's an Egyptian document from roughly 1,500 BC. The date is significant because that's roughly the time of Moses when the Jews received the Old Testament. All right, and what it is, it's a summary of medical knowledge in Egypt at that time. And historians of medical ideas would tell you probably the ancient cultures that had the greatest accumulation of medical knowledge would be the Chinese and the Egyptians. So let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. All right, here we go. To prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Reto, how's it going? He's the only gray-haired guy in here, so I had to pick on him. Okay. Now look at this one. a mixture of six fats, namely horse, hippo, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. Clearly, I've not been using that. Now, these prescriptions were being used to make the men more attractive to the women. Would you hang out with somebody with that stuff on their hair? I don't think so. Let's look at some of the other medicines found in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, pig teeth, rotten meat, the moisture from pig's ears, and excrement. Yes, even human excrement was used as medicine. So you have a little infection, take some of that stuff and smear that on there. Now, you know, we're chuckling about this, but I'm telling you, this is not funny. I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny. And it's more not funny than it's funny. Because this is tragic. The average lifespan in the ancient world was less than 20 years. It's not that people couldn't live to be 80 or 100, but almost everybody died from an infectious disease. And they had no answer. Okay? Now, in Exodus 15, verse 26, God, there's a, you know, you just read that. It's just one verse. You might not even notice it. But God says to his people, if you obey the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have the diseases of the neighboring peoples. Think about this. How many cultures that were in place 3,500 years have a continuous history of 3,500 years? Estonia? No. America? Are you kidding? The only ones that I know of are India, China, Egypt, and the Jews. Well, India, China, and Egypt, great, you know, fertile plains and all that. The Jews? Now, I would argue that one of the reasons for this is because of the medical advice that they were given by God. Now, if our friend Chris Dulles McCown was correct, then the Old Testament would have things like this in it. And I'm telling you, there's not one. I have a good friend. His name is John Clayton. He was a hardcore atheist guy. His parents were both philosophers at Columbia University, and they were professional atheists. He was working, my friend John was working for Madeline O'Hare, who was the president of the Atheist Society in America. And he was writing a book. The title was The Bible, a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. And guess what happened when my friend John Clayton did his research? He became a Christian. And here's my point. If the atheists were right, then the Bible would have things like this in it. But it doesn't. Instead, it has things like this. I'm sure everybody here in this room is aware that there are certain meats that were unclean to the Jews. Now, it just so happens every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous, and every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe. For example, pork? No. Beef? Yes. There are at least 22 known diseases carried by pork. One of them is trichinosis, a deadly disease. Now, with our modern health practices and farming practices, pork is relatively safe, but I still say cook it all the way through. But beef is relatively safe, even raw. I was in Venezuela a few years ago, and I ordered for the menu. I speak Spanish, but I didn't know what those things were, so I said, just bring me that one. All right? I made the mistake of doing that in Ukraine. Do you have any Ukrainians here? All right, I won't tell that story. It's a funny story, but I won't tell it because no Ukrainians here. All right. There's that thing in Ukraine. It's all fat. It's like pig fat. You know that one? I ordered that one. I ate the whole thing. But anyway, in this case, it brought a whole plate of raw beef. And I thought about Leviticus 11, and I ate the whole thing. Now, the Bible says, shellfish, bad. Fish with scales, good. Every kind of shellfish, lobster, clam, they all carry many, many diseases. But fish with scales is safe, even raw. We call it sushi. Now, if this was the only fact, if I didn't have any more examples than this, I think the skeptic could say, well, you know, they could maybe kind of wiggle around that. And they may wiggle around all the facts if they want. But the fact is that everybody around the Jews ate all the unclean and millions died. And many, many Jews lived because of following this law. Okay, another example, whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean. This is Numbers 19, actually. Whoever touches the dead body will be unclean for 7 days. They have to purify themselves, some hyssop, sprinkle all the things they touch, etc. And this seems like kind of a harsh law. Because what it means is whoever prepares the body for the funeral can't even attend the funeral. Why would God do that? Now, my answer is, I don't really know because God didn't say why, but I think actually maybe I know. Because dead bodies are very dangerous. This guy is Ignaz Semmelweis. He was working in a hospital in Vienna. This is in the 1840s when what we now call germ theory was just being discovered. He worked in a woman's hospital. Oh, by the way, I was teaching this class in Budapest, and I told them he was from Serbia, and afterwards one of the students pulled me and said, no, he's from Budapest. I said, I think he's from Serbia. He says, he's from Budapest, so they took me to his house. So, he's from Budapest. All right, fine. Great. Anyway, the death rate for the women in this hospital was 20%. See, in prior times, people didn't have women didn't have their children in the hospital, not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital, but because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. Because it was like a death sentence. Now, here's what they did at this hospital. The surgeons would come in the morning, they would examine the bodies of the women who died the night before, and they would immediately go up to the hospital wards and start examining the women. They got what was called puerperal fever. So what Semmelweis says, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. And you have to wash your hands very thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went from 20% to 4%. That's still not good. Now, the Bible also says that when a woman gives birth, she's unclean. And when a woman has her period, she's unclean. Now, why would God say that? Because everybody knows the Christian God hates women. That's a joke. Again, the Bible doesn't say why. Was God going to say because of the bacteria? We didn't have a word for that. Well, it's these microscopic... Well, what's a microscope? God just said they're unclean. Semmelweis said, even when you touch a live patient, thoroughly clean your hands with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%. Medical science had no answer. They said, the women, they're just hysterical. Typical male attitude, okay? 0.5%. Now, there's something about the formula. If we go back, it said, take water, hyssop, and ash from the red heifer sacrifice. Now, it just so happens that hyssop is a very oily herb. And the oil in the hyssop combined with the ash in the water makes soap. That's not so surprising. The ancients knew about making soap from herbs. But here's the thing about hyssop. 12% of the oil of hyssop contains this molecule here. It's called thymol. Now, I teach organic chemistry. And in organic chemistry, we call this category of molecules a phenol. And the first property I tell my students about phenols is that they're not poisonous to human beings, but they kill bacteria. You know that smell in a hospital, that kind of smell? It's thymol. So God's prescription, when you touch a dead body, was to clean your hands, your whole body, and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. I see medical wisdom here. That, I mean, how did Moses know this? Did anybody else use the hyssop plant? No. All right, here's another one. We're talking about leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. It did not kill the most people. Typhus killed more people. Cholera killed more people. Yellow fever killed more people. But it was the horrible way that it killed people. It's a horrible... Yes, let's leave that picture right away. Good idea. Okay? Medical science had no solution. They said it was the alignment of the stars. They said, you know, it from eating hot food or something like that. Well, go to Thailand. I don't know about that. Now, the Bible said quarantine. Full, 100% quarantine until the disease has completely disappeared. Harsh treatment. Total separation. Now, in Scandinavia, in the 15th century, there were some monks who were reading Leviticus. I don't know if you knew this, but leprosy used to be as common in Europe as it was in Asia. I don't know if you knew that. So they decided to try quarantine. And within three generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe simply by using the biblical thing. Now, again, the Bible doesn't say why. By the way, leprosy is very curable. It's caused by bacteria. You just need a certain antibiotic, it's so sad that leprosy even exists still because there's not enough money put towards solving it. But again, God never said why. Here's the principle. Even if you don't know why God said to do something, do it anyway, because then you'll have health. Now, in the New Testament, it's not so much physical health as it's spiritual health. So just a piece of advice. You see something in the Bible, it says, just do this. You say, I don't agree with that. Just do it anyway. Another interesting thing is, every one of these prescriptions, it actually created health and saved millions of lives, and yet it has spiritual meaning as well. Leprosy has a spiritual meaning. And the idea of touching a dead body has a spiritual meaning. So is the next one, which is Leviticus 17:14. Another fairly obscure verse that you think, okay, well, that's interesting. All right, so it's a religious thing. What's that have to do with anything? It says, the life of every creature is in its blood. That's why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Now, what's interesting is there are health implications of this, but there's also a spiritual implication of saying the life is in the blood. Do you know what the most common medical treatment in the 19th and the 18th and 19th century was in Europe? Bloodletting. Yes? And here's some bloodletting tools. Because medical science said if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. The Bible said the life is in the blood. For hundreds of years, medical science said the disease is in the blood. So which is right? The disease is in the blood. It actually makes sense. It would explain how the disease spreads. But there's this thing called an immune system, right? And where is the immune system found? In the blood. So if you have an infectious disease, the worst thing you want to do is drain some of the blood. Last one. And let's remember the point here. The point is, those who criticize Christianity and say, ah, whatever, you know, just, you know, scientifically unsupportable, they say the Bible's full of science errors. And no scientist could take it seriously. And again, I say, give me an example. And yet, I see things like this. All right, so for the generations to come, every male among you who's 8 days old must be circumcised. This is not even in the law of Moses. This goes all the way back to Abraham. Now, a good question is this. By the way, circumcision has some danger to it. It certainly hurts. So, two questions. Number one, why circumcision? And number two, why on the eighth day? Very specific, right? Well, let's talk about why circumcision. Now, almost everyone in the ancient world died from some sort of infectious disease, usually bacteria, sometimes fungus. And where do bacteria and fungus grow? Wherever it's dark, wet, and warm. All right? So what's the darkest, wettest, warmest place on a guy? How many lives were saved? How many lives? By the way, it was mainly women's lives that were saved. Mainly women's lives that were saved. It's been shown through multiple studies that transmission of AIDS from male to female is reduced by at least 60% if the male has been circumcised. So now they've started massive programs to circumcise adult males in parts of Africa. Okay. By the way, I have an even better biblical advice to prevent the spread of AIDS. You know what I'm talking about, right? 100% guaranteed. Stop AIDS cold, which is one man, one woman for life. The world laughs at that, but how many lives could be saved? How many lives? We're not just talking about AIDS. Bible has great medical wisdom. Now, why the eighth day? Again, I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. And by the way, I'm proposing a reason, but that may not be the reason. It's just my idea. It makes sense to me. I'm a scientist. It makes sense to me. It turns out that vitamin K, probably you knew vitamin K was necessary for blood clotting. Probably you knew that. It turns out vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. So when a baby is born, they have no vitamin K. So if you circumcise a child the day they're born, not a good idea. They will bleed out. Okay, actually, it's not the vitamin K that causes the blood clot. It's prothrombin. And prothrombin actually passes through the placenta. So when a baby is born, they have some prothrombin. Not enough, but they have some. But then because they have no vitamin K, the prothrombin actually drops even further. So where's the vitamin K come from? From bacteria. Where's the baby get the bacteria? From eating from mom. So what happens? Eats from mom, vitamin K. And then what happens is the vitamin K, the prothrombin goes up to unnaturally high levels, and then it settles back down to the equilibrium level. So I'm going to show you a graph of prothrombin in the male child's blood or female versus time. Here you go. Now, from the day a male child is born to the day that male child dies, what do you think might be the safest day to circumcise that male child? By the way, there's a margin of error in this data. The seventh day is equally good, as is the ninth day. All right? Now, this begs the question. So how did Abraham know it would be the eighth day? Well, I have two possible answers. Number one, because God told him. Or number two, because he did a scientific experiment, a double-blind scientific experiment. So what we're going to do is we're going to this is a joke. It's a joke. Ha, 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 ha. I don't think that's what happened. I really don't think so. All right. Now, what I've tried to do here, I've tried to establish the atheist idea that there is no God. It borders on irrational. I'm not saying it is irrational. I'd say it borders on irrational. But then you say, okay, fine, there's a God. Remember, I told you that I concluded there's a God about 21 years of age. But which God? It sent me on a search. You know, and believe, I was not assuming the Christian God. But we could study the Hindu scriptures, the whole thing with the turtle and the bowl of milk and all that kind of stuff, and the fact that Hinduism proposes that the universe is eternal. Now, is the universe eternal? All right, and so I say science points towards God. Now, I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I believe that. I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced of that as I am that you're sitting there in that chair. Now, here's all the evidence that I have available to me to show why I believe the Bible is inspired by God. And the science evidence is like this much. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny fraction. I could talk about messianic prophecies fulfilled. I could talk about the consistency of the Bible, the historical accuracy of the Bible, all those other things. But you can ask questions about that. But that's not our topic tonight. So what we're going to do is we're going to stop and we're going to take as many questions as you want. The questions could relate to the topic tonight, or it could be a Bible question, a theology question of some sort. If you want to have me help you with your sociology homework, I'm not going to do that. But anything related to the topic or related to Christianity. By the way, I have a website. Did some of you get cards there? If you go there, there are 2,500 questions that I've answered and published at my website. All right, so if we don't get your question answered tonight, send it to me at the website. But if you go to my website, do a little search, you young people, you're good at that, I think you'd find the answer. Any questions? I'm telling you, Norwegian people, they don't ask questions. They're so shy. In America. And it's worse even in, I won't say which country. So, prove yourself better than those Norwegians. Ask some questions. Yeah?
Do you remember any of the unscientific examples, if anyone has proposed?
For what?
From the Bible. Like many people usually, they talk about like Noah's Ark.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, basically, the position that some people take is science proves that there is no miracle. The Bible has miracles, therefore it's unscientific, therefore it's not true. That's a very common argument. But actually, that is a logical fallacy. And here's why. Science deals with the natural. Okay? In fact, the only kind of phenomena scientists even know how to study is the natural. So if all you're studying is the natural, what can you say about the supernatural? If you're honest, nothing. Basically, a miracle is an event which, by definition, violates the natural laws. So in order to use a study of the natural world to prove there's no supernatural world, that's a logic error. All right, so science could do is science could say, if that happened, that would be supernatural. Science can help us there. For example, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead on the fourth day. All right? Well, if that happened, and I believe it did, that was a miracle. Now, I would apply that to the flood of Noah. Does the Bible describe the flood of Noah as a natural event? Not at all. By the way, I believe the flood happened. Now, one thing that gets some Christian believers in trouble is they forget whether they believe in something because of the evidence from whether they believe something because it's in the Bible. So let me tell you a few things I believe, not just because it's in the Bible, but because the evidence takes me there. Number one, I believe the universe was created. Now, the Bible agrees with that, but I believe the universe was created because of the evidence. I believe life was created supernaturally. All right, I'm convinced of that. Now, the Bible agrees with that, but I believe that because the evidence leaves me no other choice. I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I mean, the evidence for that is absolutely overwhelming. So the reason I believe the Bible is inspired by God is because of the evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day because of the evidence. Okay. Now, I also believe in heaven, and I have no evidence for heaven. None at all. I believe in Adam and Eve. Now, I believe that humans are a supernatural creation given the qualities we have. I could talk about that. Our self-awareness, the fact that we can understand the universe. I think that it's reasonable to believe that humans were supernaturally created. However, I'm going to tell you this. I believe in Adam and Eve because it's in the Bible. Okay? And I believe in the flood. And the principal reason I believe in the flood is because it's in the Bible. And the Bible is inspired by God. Jesus, the guy who walked on water, who raised Lazarus from the dead, who fulfilled all the messianic prophecies, who was himself raised from the dead, he believed in the flood. You know what? That's good enough for me. Now, there is some evidence that a worldwide flood happened. There is. But that evidence is not overwhelming, and it's not sufficient to say that it's proof from that evidence. All right? Now, getting back to your question finally. So I believe the flood happened, and if science says, well, that can't have happened, I say it was a miracle. And the reason it happened is the Bible says why it happened. Okay? That's my response to that question. But you're asking, well, maybe while I'm taking the next question, you can think of another thing like, yeah, this must be a problem. So I'm going to take the next question and feel free to ask me another example. Yes?
Just in what you discovered and your research and everything, and just what you think, does God creating the world mean that something like evolution didn't happen?
Okay, now, I have a 45-minute presentation I could do on evolution. But, okay, good. So this requires me to back up a little bit. Now, if the Genesis creation account, which describes 7 days, if that is a literal account of what actually happened historically, then I'll tell you right now, the theory of evolution is totally wiped out. Because that would mean the Earth is only, whatever, say 10, 20, 30,000 years old. And clearly, there were no dinosaurs around. Now, let me talk about the age of the Earth a little bit, and then I'll get back to evolution. All right. Now, I believe that the Genesis creation account is a description of what happened, but it's not a scientific account. It's really a theological account. Basically, it says this. God created the universe. I agree with that. God created the Earth. He created water on the earth. He created life in the water. Then he created life on the land. Then he created more, complex forms of life. Then he created us. Okay, that's consistent. That agrees. But I believe that those days are metaphorical. All right. I like what Galileo said. He said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So the Bible is not a science book, it's a God book. So the creation account is telling us about God, not about science. Nevertheless, it just so happens, at least in the broad outline, it fits. So I believe that those days, basically what Genesis is saying, First God did this, then he did this, then he did this, and then he did this. In fact, even the ancient Jews recognized that the days almost certainly were metaphorical. Philo, the first century Jewish philosopher, said these days represent the periods over which God worked. Now, by the way, I believe God could create the earth to appear old. In fact, I teach a philosophy of science class. Actually, I retired, but I did until a year ago in San Diego. And San Diego is a very religiously conservative area, so I have a lot of young earth people there, a lot. You might be surprised. So here's what I do when I'm teaching that class. I ask them, first of all, what does science say about the age of the earth? They say, 4.5 billion years. Then I say, does that prove the earth is that old? They say, no. All it says is the evidence points there. See, they've been trained. I say, so I'm going to defend the young earth idea. And I literally did it right then and there. So I actually say, I'm going to walk over there, and I'm going to stop speaking as a scientist. I'm going to speak as a theologian. They don't know that I actually study theology. But anyway, so I say, all right, so now I'm speaking as a theologian, not as a scientist. Now, let's just propose for the sake of argument that there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, you know, all those omni-God, just as a starting argument. Could that God create the universe and the earth so that it appears old at the moment of creation? Well, obviously. All right, so if we propose that, might that explain why the earth appears old? I mean, could it conceivably? Yeah, it could. Well, if that's true, then if we looked at the earth, what would it appear like? Old. All right, come back over here. Now, does all the scientific evidence point towards the earth being old? Yes, it does. Sorry, young earthers, I'm sorry. There is no evidence to support the young earth. All right? So, okay. But again, I'm going to be the scientist. I'm going to challenge the theologian just for a minute. All right? Now, let's say I'm looking through a telescope and I see light coming from a galaxy that's 1 billion light years away. So how long ago did those photons leave that galaxy? Let me help you out. 1 billion light years away. So how long ago did those photons leave that galaxy? 1 billion years ago. So how old is that galaxy? At least 1 billion years old. Yeah. But John the Baptist said, out of these stones, I could create children of Abraham. And I believe it. I'm a Christian. I believe that. Jesus made wine. It was ready to go. All fermented, ready to go. He made fish. You know, it appeared to be at least 2 or 3 years old. Was he deceiving us? Yeah, but you have to admit, that's kind of odd. I mean, you know, what about the dinosaurs? So we're not going to end this debate, okay? I don't think it's crazy or stupid for a Christian to hold on to this young earth idea. I don't agree with it at all. For philosophical, so many reasons. But now, so I'm going to answer your question based on the idea that the earth is apparently quite old. Now, the Bible says that God created all species. Does the Bible say how he created all species? No, it doesn't. It's all kinds of stuff it doesn't say. So I say, God created evolution. How smart is that? I mean, evolution, the fact that evolution can happen is an amazing, astounding fact, which I don't know how atheists can kind of really get their hands around that. So if God created evolution, then why would Christians get all defensive about it? That's my response. Now, then the next question is, well, what about human beings? You know, do they come from apes or something like that? No, they came from a common ancestor. That's what the scientific evidence says. But I thought you believed in Adam and Eve. I do. There's a reason I believe in Adam and Eve, because it's in the Bible. And besides, how could a self-aware, spiritual creature that's capable of understanding the universe and that has free will. And I mean, these things could not evolve. Could our bodies have evolved? Maybe. You know, could it have evolved without God's input there? All right. Anyway, enough on that question. Next question. I'm taking 10 minutes per question. Sorry about that. Old people, no. Old people, no. Not until the young people are almost done. All right, yes. What's that? Stephen Hawking?
Theory.
Mm-hmm. Which theory?
Universe.
But which theory? You mean the multiverse theory?
Yes.
All right. All right. Stephen Hawking, I don't know if you know who he is. He died recently. He's this guy who had ALS. So he's quite famous. He was the one who predicted black holes exist and that they exude a certain kind of radiation. Okay, that's great. Now, earlier in his career, Stephen Hawking was a deist. Early in his career. In other words, he believed that there's sufficient design in the universe to imply a designer. But later on, he became an atheist. All right? So, Stephen Hawking is a cosmologist, all right, and a high-energy physicist. So obviously he's well aware of the fine-tuned universe, okay? And yet, later on in his life, like I said, he became an atheist. So what's an atheist going to do? They got two choices. They could say, I mean, the fact that the universe has these things is a coincidence so great that only an irrational person wouldn't believe in God. But that's not going to work for Stephen Hawking. So what does Stephen Hawking do? He says he believes in the multiverse theory. But the multiverse, there's so many problems with that. First of all, why does anything exist? It doesn't answer that question. What is the evidence for the multiverse? There's none. Can the multiverse theory be disproved by experiment? It can't. So why does the multiverse theory even exist? So that atheists have something to say. Now, that's my reaction. Now, Stephen Hawking is dead, so he can't defend his theory. But I would say that that is not even a scientific theory. It's what I call an ad hoc theory. That's a big fancy thing. Ad hoc means to this. In other words, an ad hoc theory is a theory created not because of any evidence. It's a theory created to explain something. And ad hoc theories are, they're really not scientific. All right, so that's my response. A great scientist, but in this case, he's so obviously wrong, I don't know how to respond to that. Well, I turned down one old person, so Reto, you're next. Sorry. But old means over 22. Over 22. Ah, yes, Reto.
Yeah, you said before that we should ask the scientists why they don't believe evidences. But you were more around the scientists more often. Can you give a hint?
Well, the Bible gives a hint. The Bible gives a hint. Remember I quoted... it's been obvious so that men are without excuse. And right after that, it says, they gave themselves over and they worship created things rather than the Creator. And so, you know, this is a common human trait to worship created things because they're visible. All right, now, another possibility is that if you believe in a God, that means you're accountable to that God. And if you're accountable to God, that means you got a problem. All right? It means you have to change your life. But whether that's the reason that an atheist chooses atheism, because, but that's for them to say. It's not for me to say. But I would say that it is a fairly common and a tempting thing to worship created things because they're visible. And that's what ancient peoples tended to do. They worship created things. So the scientist is kind of like an animist from the past. You know, they're worshiping a created thing rather than the thing that created it. Anyway, it's not a very good answer. My actual answer in my heart that I have, I'm not going to say, because it's to judge somebody, and I don't want to judge somebody in that way. I don't want to. I feel to be ungracious for me to judge people. So I'm going to still leave it as that's for them to answer. Okay, question?
Which is not one-on-one in many versions of English Bible.
Okay.
But for example, Psalm 26:2, it says that prove me, Lord Jehovah, and test me and examine my kidneys and my heart. I'm wondering and unknowing that this Estonian translation, a lot of kidneys are kind of mentioned. And I was wondering.
All right, Psalm 26. Now, first of all, when you're reading the Psalms, you're reading poetry. And poetry is always filled with metaphor and emotion, yes? And so, which verse is that? Yeah. So, here's the thing is, the ancient people, first of all, they didn't literally believe that the heart, you know, they didn't, you know. But ancient people, rather than saying the heart, said the liver. I guess the kidneys, I guess. So probably, I'm not sure, but I would guess the Hebrew word is probably examine my liver. I think so. But the people who translate into the English language understand that David is speaking metaphorically anyway, right? You say, oh, my heart fell in love. You don't literally mean your heart fell in love. You meant some neurotransmitters and were kind of being produced in your brain, and suddenly all these things started happening. So David is using metaphor. It's possible that the Estonian Bible might actually be closer to the Hebrew. Because if I'm not mistaken, I know some people said liver. Other people said heart. But none of them said brain. They had no idea about the brain, what it did. All right, so it's a metaphor anyway. And so, again, if the English translation says heart, it's because those who speak English, that's how they would say it. So the translator has to do some things. Talk to the translator. But again, they're trying to make it clear, right? In fact, there's a verse in Ezra where it says Ezra read the scriptures and he made it clear because it was in Hebrew and these people spoke Aramaic. So what he would do is he would translate it. And he would translate it so that it would be clear to those who listened. And I'm sure he made a few choices in his mind to not be literal, because then his audience would be confused. Okay? So anyway, David says a lot of things that aren't literally true. For example, David said, I was a sinner at birth. That's not true. He's just puking his emotions. He said in Psalm 51, he said, God, against you only have I sinned. Well, that's not true. He sinned against Uriah, don't you think so? Do you think he sinned against Bathsheba? So, again, we don't read Psalms the same way we read the book of Romans. In Romans, it's a doctrinal book, and we read that quite literally, usually. But understand that, because in Romans and John and Ezekiel, that's God speaking to man. But Psalms is man speaking to God. So we interpret it differently. Okay? Another question.
What do you think of the argument about moral law that I think Francis Collins used and some philosophers have used to prove God?
Right. In fact, there's a slide in my presentation. I had a Francis Collins slide. I took it out. So Francis Collins, first of all, most people here don't know who he is. Francis Collins was the one who headed the Genome Project, the one that decoded the human genome in the late 1990s. And then he became the head of the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. So he is arguably the most influential scientist in America. And he's a Christian. I actually met him personally. And, I got to talk to him a little bit. And so, anyway, in his book, The Language of God, he lists either six or seven reasons that he says that God exists. One of them is the fact that anything exists at all, which I mentioned. Another one is the fine-tuning of the universe. But one of them is the idea of moral law. In other words, he believes that in moral law. Now, first of all, ethics is one thing, morality is something else. Okay, ethics is a weighing of cost and benefit. So atheists can be ethical. In fact, I know a lot of atheists, and I think atheists are as likely to be ethical as you and I. Morality, though, has to do with right and wrong. And the very concept of morality implies an authority, a higher authority. Okay? And Francis Collins, as I believe, that rape is wrong. He believes that murder is wrong. That lying is not just unethical, it's also wrong. And that's the moral argument. There are many arguments for the existence of God, but one of the powerful arguments for the existence of God is called the moral argument. And here's the premise. The premise is there are moral laws. Therefore, there's a source of those moral laws, and that source is God. That's a powerful argument for the existence of God. Because if the atheist is correct, then it is not wrong to rape somebody. And it is not wrong to commit genocide. And it is not wrong to murder and to steal. Now, it might be unadvisable, but it's not wrong. Now, all of us in this room disagree with that. So if you believe in moral law, then you have to believe in God. So that's one of Francis Collins. He has six of them. And I think he has others. Those are the ones he puts in his book, because it's geared towards non-believers. All right, great, good. That was like a great, it's like a, we call that a softball question. You know. Yes?
So basically, why is it so that when we read the Bible, we can see a lot of miracles happening, for example, like angels appearing, talking to people, like directly telling them like what they should do, or for example, disciples.
Sure. So are you asking why do miracles happen?
No, I'm asking why we can't see it today.
Okay. Actually, if you look at the Old Testament, miracles are very rare in the Old Testament. They're very rare. There's whole periods of hundreds of years where there are no miracles. In fact, if you read in Psalms, one of the things they're complaining about is, how come there's no miracles lately? So God does not do miracles just for no particular reason. So if you're late to work and the traffic light is turning red, I suggest don't pray to God to turn it green. Just say, amen, God, it's red. God does not intervene just for no particular reason. God does not intervene in our life. We have this thing called free will. I believe God only intervenes in nature for a definite reason. And in history, God has intervened only rarely. Specifically, during the time of Moses and the escape from Egypt, many miracles happened at that time. Also, during the time of Elijah and Elisha. And also when Israel entered the promised land. But through most of the history, even of the Old Testament, miracles are fairly rare. Now, I believe miracles happen today, but not of the sort like Jesus walking on water. There's a reason why Jesus walked on water. It was to give testimony that he was from God. Okay? And in fact, in Hebrews chapter 2, verse about 4, it says, there are reasons that signs, wonders, and miracles were used is to testify that the message is from God. So God, because the Jews asked Jesus, what's your authority to say these things? He says, look at the miracles. So, do you have new revelation from God? No? Do you have new revelation from God? No? Do you have new revelation from God? Does anybody have brand new revelation from God? Not that I know of. So why would God work that kind of a miracle? I believe God works miracles, small miracles. I believe that God will help. I believe that God will heal somebody in certain cases. But I believe because of free will, God does not normally interfere in that way. All right? In fact, there's a story of the rich man and Lazarus. And he said, go back and work a miracle. And he said, hey, if he doesn't believe the words of Moses, he's not going to believe even if somebody was raised from the dead. So, God worked miracles in a special way at certain times. And I believe God normally does not do that because he doesn't want to interfere with our free will. Okay? Great question. Any other great questions, or even just pretty good ones? Yes?
John, you've been a disciple for like 40 years. Have you had big doubts about Christianity during this time?
What do you mean?
Is this the right thing, question?
Have I had big thoughts? Doubts. Oh, doubts! I'm sorry, doubts. I have doubts all the time. How could you not have doubts? Like I said, I have a short list of things I'm absolutely sure about. One of them is that the Bible is inspired by God. That kind of helps me deal with doubts. Let me give you an example, not from the Bible. I believe that my wife is, always has been, and always will be faithful to me. In fact, I have so much reason to believe that if I saw evidence that appeared to be contrary to that, I would know right away that that's not true. If I heard that somebody saw my wife on a date with some guy, I would instantly, completely, whatever. Either it wasn't her, or there's a perfectly good explanation. My wife deserves the benefit of the doubt 100%. Absolutely. I would say that works for me as well. For example, I see people say, there's this contradiction in the Bible. And I kind of go, I've been there, done that 100 times. In fact, every time somebody shows me there's a contradiction, when I kind of track it down, I go, oh, okay. So it's like people telling me reasons not to believe in the Bible. It makes me believe the Bible more. But I still have doubts, even now. Do I ever doubt that when I die, my body will be raised from the dead? I don't know. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. In fact, when I was a young Christian, I thought, I don't want to be cremated. You see that? I don't want to be cremated. Then I realized how silly that is. I say, no, I want to be cremated just as a way to show my faith even more. Things that I can't see, I always have doubts. I mean, do I ever have doubts like, that there's going to be a heaven. Yeah, those thoughts come into my mind. But then I go back and I look at the messianic prophecies. You know, there's a messianic prophecy that says the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Now, what famous person was born in Bethlehem? There's a messianic prophecy that says that the Messiah would actually come from Galilee, near Nazareth. Okay. There's a messianic prophecy that says that the Messiah would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Now, how much was Jesus betrayed for? There's a messianic prophecy that says the Messiah would be crucified by piercing hands and feet. Now, can anybody inform me, how was it that Jesus died? And we go on and on and on. So at some point, I understand that my doubts are not rational anymore, but I still have them. Yeah. In fact, doubt is necessary. Doubt is necessary for faith. Because if you don't doubt, then what kind of faith is that? Younger people, especially young people, they need to doubt. And parents of young people, they need to let their young people doubt. Because if they don't doubt, then how can they believe? So parents, stop getting all worried when your kids are doubting. Okay, I got worried when my kids were doubting too. It's normal. But we have to doubt. Because if we don't doubt, then the faith we have is borrowed faith. And borrowed faith is not faith. So it always makes Christian parents really nervous when their kids doubt. But they have to. Okay? Good question. By the way, Room for Doubt. There's a website out there. It's called Room for Doubt. It's produced by a friend of mine. And it's a whole website devoted to the idea that doubt is good and healthy and necessary in Christianity. It's called Room for Doubt. .com or .org, I don't know. All right? Yeah?
How to prove that the New Testament is inspired by God? Because it seems to be somewhat easier to prove that about the Old Testament. But, for example, Paul was still a normal person, or, I don't know, Luke or John. And it feels like they just sat down and wrote. And anyone could do that. But what would be a reasonable...
So the premise then is, although it's obvious that Daniel's inspired, how do I know the New Testament is inspired? But first of all, logically, if Jesus fulfilled all the prophecies of the Messiah, and if he fulfilled all the types, prefigures, and foreshadows of the Messiah, and if he was raised from the dead, and he walked on water... then it seems to me logically that God's probably involved in this whole thing. I mean, and so so it's not exactly, but if your premise is that the New Testament shows the inspiration of the Old Testament, but the Old Testament doesn't show the inspiration of the New Testament, I think that's partly true. I mean, in other words, Judaism and Christianity are the only religions that exist in history. And that history creates evidence for the inspiration, right? But the New Testament, it only happens in a short time. So if the premise is the direct evidence for the inspiration of the New Testament is less than the Old Testament, I agree with that. But on the other hand, I read a book like Hebrews, and that book is it's ridiculous. I mean, it's so amazing. One way to test this is just like you've heard of the Old Testament Apocrypha, all right, like Tobit and Judith and First Maccabees. Read the Old Testament Apocrypha. You'll go, okay, now I get it. Similarly, read the New Testament Apocrypha, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas. Compare that to the New Testament, you'll go, oh, okay, I get it now. I mean, even if you read the legitimate writings of Christians in the first and second century, like Clement of Rome and stuff like that, you go, well, that's pretty good. But or how about this? Read one of my books and then read the Bible and say, you know, try to pretend they're on the same level. And that's ridiculous immediately. Like I said last night, you could spend your whole life just studying the book of Colossians. You'd never even reach the end of it. Any human writing? it's a joke. But it's true. The premise is that the New Testament is not as obviously inspired by the actual evidence because it's not immersed in history. It's not. But there is predictive prophecy. All right. For example, Jesus said, you know, that Jerusalem will be surrounded by the armies, and it was. And there is prophecy. There's prophecy in the New Testament that was fulfilled in New Testament times, but the quantity is less. Okay, well, you know, we've been going for almost 2 hours. That might be enough. People get tired, and the teams definitely get... Okay, let's just... All right, last question. Okay, yeah, that's a great question. It's a classic question. But surely everybody hopefully asked that question. If not, then you should probably think a little bit more. All right, so now, premise number one, something exists. All right, premise number two, those things have not always existed. Therefore, something created those things, right? So if anything exists at all, then there has to be an uncaused cause, all right? That's called the cosmological argument, all right? And so I don't think Francis Collins mentions the cosmological argument. So the cosmological argument says this: everything which begins to exist is caused. Therefore, there has to be a cause of that thing, and that cause is, by definition, God. Now, some people would say, sounds logical, but it doesn't convince me of God at all. Fine, I mean, that's not going to help most people. I believe that's a pretty tight argument. All right, so, when Moses asked God, who should I send me? He said, I am. When they confronted Jesus about his authority to work miracles, he said, before Abraham was born, I am. So what does God say about himself? He says, I am. God is, by definition, the self-existent being. Now, that'll give you a headache. If you think about that for too long, that'll give you a headache. But the fact is, something exists. Therefore, God has to exist. Now, the question is, who created God? That's a nonsense question. I'm not accusing you of nonsense, but technically, who created God is a nonsense question. Because God created time itself, created. That means past tense, you know, future, past. But the God that exists is a God who exists outside of time. So created does not apply to God. Now you could say, well, that's not very convincing. Okay, well, then if you could think of another way to explain reality, you know, go for it. All right? And I know this one's going way over the head of most people in this room, which is fine. But to me, this is a compelling philosophical argument. By the way, it's not the reason I believe in God. All right? Very good. So thanks for listening to me, and thanks for coming. But wait, I want to take a picture. I'm going to post it on Facebook. So if you don't want to be on Facebook, run out of the room right now. Okay, here we go. All right, campus students in Tallinn. Thank you.
For speaking tonight.
Sure.
Thank you everyone for coming. If you're interested and you want to know more, just talk to the person who invited you. But thanks and have a good night.
There's a few books out there. Don't make me take them to Riga. That book on Daniel's awesome, by the way. It's my second best book. I don't know why I didn't sell any copies.
That's great.
Thank
you. I have
you.
A follow-up question right on top of the last one.
Okay.
On top of the